All right, and welcome back to another episode of Smart Crypto Investing. I'm your host, Chuck Rivers. Thank you so much for joining in for another exciting episode. This week, we're going to be speaking with a special guest, but before we do, I just wanted to let you guys know, you can check us out on Facebook at Smart Crypto Investing. You can head over to smartcryptoinvesting.org as well. And also, you can find that podcast on iTunes, and we'll shortly be on iHeartRadio as well. So, Jim, welcome to Smart Crypto Investing.
Hey, Charles. Thanks a lot for having me on.
No problem, man. We're really excited. Glad you decided to come on and join us today. So by the time people are actually listening to this episode, it's going to be January 1st, 2018. And from what I've been hearing and reading as far as in the cryptocurrency space, it's going to be a big year for cryptocurrency. But before we get into that, Jim, tell us, our listeners, a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so one of the things that I use as a potential icebreaker for people when I meet them for the first time is I let them know that English was not actually my first language. My first language is actually Spanish. I'm from Panama, came to the United States as a young man. And so it's interesting that when I speak to people, one of the things they say is, well, you don't have an accent in English. And I don't have an accent in Spanish either, which is kind of an unusual combination. But that's things like that can happen when you learn languages at a young age. So for your listeners that have kids, implore them to learn a second language, but do that at a young age, because it'll be much easier for them later. But what I do today is I actually run a small consultancy that focuses on small businesses, specifically around what I'll call general business consulting. I also do alternative finance for business enterprises that are unsuccessful in acquiring financing from the commercial banking system, don't have the means or the capacity or even the will to proceed towards a more formal Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceeding. We offer an alternative to that. Prior to this, I was in telecommunications and technology for many, many years, a variety of roles in that capacity. And my academic background is I have 2 degrees in industrial engineering. So that's who I am.
Oh, nice. And so your last name is pronounced Mascara, Jim Mascara?
That's correct.
Okay. I didn't want to butcher it. So so one of the, I'm always fascinated when, especially in particularly with entrepreneurs and how they got started into transitioning into the entrepreneurial space. And from a lot of readings that I do and some people that I know personally, people fell into entrepreneurship for different reasons or for different causes, I would say. So what led you to the world of entrepreneurship?
Yeah, great question. After I graduated from college, I went to work in the telecommunications field, but I always had a very kind of a latent interest in money. Probably just my dad and I having a lot of discussions about money when growing up. Probably my favorite class in school and college that was not related to engineering, one of my electives was one called money and banking. Piqued my interest a lot. And so when I got out of college, I started trading commodities a little bit on the side, in my own account, had some success with it, and then proceeded to acquire the certification for what's called the Series 3, which is to become a commodity trading advisor. I never pursued that path, but was always very, very close to money, investments, and so forth, the economy. And really, even the stuff we'll end up talking about today, a lot of this is self-taught. And so around the time of the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, I started writing for a national publication called Examiner.com on financial and economic topics. 2010, I published my first book in the Escaping Oz series. And so it kind of proceeded from there, just very, very strong interest in money. But after having watched, kind of anticipated, I'm not going to say I was so prophetic, I knew exactly how the financial crisis was going to play out. But in having a lot of conversations with people and just kind of anecdotal things that I picked up here and there, I knew there was a really, really big problem in the housing market. And so obviously we know what happened after that. Yeah. But as I got more into it, I realized that there was a need there to help small businesses who, for the most part, entrepreneurs, you said they've got their head down, they're busy working, in their business, but they also need to work on their business and the things that are around it to make it successful. And so that was kind of a passion of mine as well. So when I left the telecommunications world, I kind of used the accumulated knowledge over time, and then I set up this consultancy.
Oh, nice. Now, the big question that I ask all my guests that I bring on to Smart Crypto Investing is, is what was your beginning with Bitcoin / cryptocurrency? Like, when did you first hear about it? And when did you start really realizing, or I guess getting into, or maybe you may not realize, but you know, I know because some people still aren't on the cryptocurrency bandwagon, but when did you first hear about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency?
Well, believe it or not, I mentioned earlier that I published my first book in 2010. I actually talked about Bitcoin in the year 2010. Mm-hmm. And I talked about it not so much from an investing perspective, because the book it was called Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. Mm-hmm. There was a chapter in there that I talked about deflation, and you know, deflation is a contraction in the quantity of outstanding money and credit. And so one of the things I wanted to do was talk about things that could be deflationary in our economy. And there were a number of examples in there. And I brought up Bitcoin from the standpoint of that would be a way where participants in the economy would, let's say, obviate the need to be in dollar-based transactions and would start transacting in something else. In this case, it was Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. You know, so what I envisioned at the time was is that, you know, this is something that's, you know, it's not going away. I didn't necessarily think about it from an investing standpoint, but more, you know, what sort of effect it could potentially have on the economy. And, you know, if you go back, I remember reading the original white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto, and I'm gonna read you here verbatim. You know, when he developed this, he said it's a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash that would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. And so that's some of what I discussed in that book, was that, you know, hey, what sort of effect is this going to have economically if all of a sudden we have an alternative means of transacting payments? Mm.
Yeah, and for me, I'd say unfortunately or unfortunately, I'm only recently hearing about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. I mean, I knew eventually that some type of digital currency was going to hit the scene, but I just really wasn't too focused on it until actually this year when, you know, of course, Bitcoin hit record numbers. As far as I think, it started at the beginning of the year as $1,000. If I'm not mistaken, and ended up at, I think the highest it did like last month before was 20,000. Now it's back down to around 13. So it definitely caught the attention of a lot of people who had first written off Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general. So very fascinating stuff. So I guess as you transition into 2018, and 2018 being that it's expected to be a big year for cryptocurrency, where do you see things taking shape as far as Bitcoin is concerned going into 2018?
Well, I think probably one thing that would be helpful, I think, in our discussion is to try to provide a good foundation about Bitcoin. And I'm going to reference later. We'll talk about my author site where I've got some links to some articles on a publication called Seeking Alpha, where I wrote two articles, one in August and one just this month in December, where I kind of talked about Bitcoin not so much from a, you know, here's what you need to do investing purposes wise, but really understanding what it is. And, you know, when I read that part of Satoshi Nakamoto's abstract that he wrote in, I don't know, 2008 or 2009, you know, he's expressly talked about it being a means of payment, right? And so when you get into something like that, it's important to understand, well, what is Bitcoin exactly? And so when I wrote the article in August, I said, you know, here's what I talked about in my Escaping Oz book about what money is, you know, and so when you talk about money, there's three things that it needs to be. It needs to be a medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a direct store representation of wealth. Well, so what I started doing was I said, okay, is it possible then that Bitcoin meets these characteristics? And it does. And so when you look at it from that standpoint, then Bitcoin is money. And so the other thing about looking at something in terms of money is, okay, if it's money, then let's talk about the utility. So because for money to be useful, it has to have utility. I've got to be able to use it to purchase goods and services. So, you know, it's exchanging value, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I talked about in the book I referenced in the Escaping Oz book was that, you know, at the time that I wrote the first book in 2010, very, very limited number of transactions that you could actually do with Bitcoin. And even today, if you just do a Google search on, let's say, online vendors that accept Bitcoin, it's a fairly limited number. probably the most well-known is Overstock.com, that they will accept Bitcoin as payment. So what you have to ask yourself is, okay, if this thing called Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies are going to operate as money, then they need to have a greater utility value to exchange goods or services with some entity. And I think right now that is not ubiquitous, so it's not widespread. And so the utility of Bitcoin is lacking a little bit. Well, actually, I'd say more than a little bit.
Yeah.
And then so the other aspect of it is, okay, well, is Bitcoin an investment? Because I've heard it described, well, you know, it's an asset, right? And so if you look at investments traditionally, and again, I'm using very traditional terms here, you know, Bitcoin doesn't confer any ownership in a company. So it's not like it's interesting. I've heard my son the other day talking about it just generically to somebody. He's like, well, you know, how many shares of Bitcoin do you own? You know, but, you know, and it's interesting because I think when people think about it in terms of an asset, they're thinking, okay, well, I have, you know, some ownership in a company. Well, there's not, you know, there's no ownership in any company. There is no, yeah. Now I remember even having a discussion today with somebody and they're like, well, you know, I mean, describing Bitcoin as like some sort of an entity, you know, again, like a company or something, like, no, it's not what it is either. And so it doesn't have any cash flow from dividends. It's not like a bond because you don't get a cash flow or the expected return of principal. It doesn't have characteristics like real estate, whether it's developed or undeveloped. So you can't lease out Bitcoin and expect a cash flow from that. It's not like fine art or numismatic coins, you know, or for your stamp collector. So there's no aesthetic value to it. So, you know, so then you start asking yourself the question, well, you know, is this really an asset? And to me, it's been turned into an asset by unbridled speculation.
Yeah.
But really, if you go back to Nakamoto's original intent for what this thing is, and other cryptocurrencies for that matter, it's really intended to be money. And so if you're going to treat it as money, then it has to be more widely, broadly adopted within, you know, the economic ecosystem where you have merchants. You know, you can go down the street and, you know, I can buy a cup of coffee with Bitcoin. And that hasn't occurred yet. So in answer, this is kind of a long answer to your question, you know, going into 2018, you know, we better see more utility for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Otherwise, what you're going to see is what you've seen in 2017, which is a lot of speculation and a lot of, you know, volatility.
Yeah. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I'm fairly new into the cryptocurrency space, but I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of research. And from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, is that when it comes to particularly Bitcoin, and of course there's other cryptocurrency, but when it comes to Bitcoin, that the transaction speeds are actually not as fast as some of the other coins out there on the market, a lot of other currencies. So, but because Bitcoin is so popular, I think more people are flooding towards Bitcoin as opposed to some of the other currencies that have faster transaction speeds that are trying to achieve the same thing that Bitcoin is trying to achieve.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because I can give you a real life example of, you're talking about transaction speeds. I bought something not too long ago at Overstock.com just as a test, and I thought, okay, let me use some Bitcoin to buy it because they accept it.
Yeah.
And for your listeners, this isn't like going to Amazon. You put in your credit card, you type, you know, you click a button, and your credit card gets approved instantaneously, and you know, it tells you, oh, you know, your shipment is on the way, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's not how this is at all. As a matter of fact, with Bitcoin, you know, you're anticipated that there's going to be a lag time. In fact, here's how it happens. You buy the thing at Overstock.com, and they tell you, okay, here's the dollar value of it. You need to send, you know, whatever fraction amount of Bitcoin to us at Overstock to this particular wallet address in order to complete the transaction. So, and when you do that, you know, you better make sure that you have the wallet address correct, because if you don't have the wallet address correct, that Bitcoin, yes, that money that you sent through cyberspace could be lost forever. So that's one. Secondly, after you make that transaction and you send it from your wallet, there's a lag time there. And so, you know, you're sitting there kind of looking at the screen, okay, is this approved? Is it not?
Yeah.
You know, and so And so part of the impetus, I think, for Litecoin was to have, you know, faster transaction speeds. But in all of these cases, you know, there is a, you know, mathematical verification process that's going on that requires, you know, some amount of lag, right? Because that's the whole part of, you know, about Bitcoin mining, right? There's some serious math going on that even today, as some of your listeners may know, as you get closer to the end of the maximum number of Bitcoins minted, which is 21 million, the mathematical computations become progressively more more difficult. Yeah. And so much so that it's requiring, as I understand right now, that all the Bitcoin mining in the world is consuming more electricity than whole countries. So again, so that speaks to some of the technical and fundamental challenges that are ahead of Bitcoin, particularly as you get closer to the end of the mining period.
Yeah, and to kind of confirm what you said as far as the transaction speed, I did something similar, but I wasn't buying anything. I was actually transferring money from a Coinbase to another exchange to buy some more coins. So I have had a bit of Bitcoin, I had a bit of Litecoin. I said, you know what, let me test to see what you know, which goes through first. So I actually did the Bitcoin first. I transferred the Bitcoin and I transferred the Litecoin. And by the time the Litecoin was hit the other exchange, I had already purchased coins and the Bitcoin was still pending. I'm like, wow, that's, yeah. You know, that's, I guess that's one of the downfalls of using Bitcoin, is that just because there's so many people using it.
You mentioned Coinbase, and so in Coinbase, you know, if for those users that have used Coinbase within the last month, there have been warnings that have come out from Coinbase where, you know, the exchange was down, you couldn't do anything, or the traffic volume, you know, was very, very heavy. So, you know, if you're trying to, so now let's move into the speculative aspect of Bitcoin, not the utility value as money. If I'm sitting there trying to speculate in Bitcoin and all of a sudden I can't execute a transaction because A, the exchange is down, or there's heavy volume, I mean, that's a big problem as an investor. The other huge problem that I don't hear talked about very much at all, and I read, you know, a decent number of Bitcoin articles, is for all of the Bitcoin millionaires, if you have your money, if you have your Bitcoin in Coinbase, how much money can you withdraw and change into US dollars? Well, there's a limit to that. And there's a base limit that Coinbase imposes on you. And if you want to go to progressively higher amounts, they ask you for more information, probably under the Know Thy Customer rule, to make sure you're not, you know, laundering money and so forth. Yeah. But, you know, if you're sitting on $1 million worth of Bitcoin, you can't just press a button and say, at least from what I can tell on Coinbase, you can't just press a button and say, okay, hey, wire this to Charles's account at Bank of America instantaneously. It's not going to, I don't know how they do that. And in fact, I don't see a way to do that. And so the liquidity, and again, so this gets back to the speculative aspect, you know, the trading aspect of Bitcoin, the liquidity in these cryptocurrencies is not very high with respect to, again, that conversion to a more widespread money like a US dollar or euro, what have you.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, Jim. So there's been a lot of speculation as far as the IRS, you know, getting involved. And so currently as it stands, we know that cryptocurrency is decentralized, but it looks like some of the bigger institutions are more so waiting for that centralization or that regulation of cryptocurrency before they actually put both feet in. Because we hear on the news, I do a lot of reading on Cointelegraph, and there's a lot of, you know, major corporations that are hinting at it, but then they're not really taking that move. And in my opinion, is because again, it's not regulated. But as we start to see more regulation coming into the space, do you see that being like a green light for some of the larger corporations to get in?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about things like, you know, hedge funds, pension plans, and so forth, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility. So in theory, the more regulation there is there, it should make it more palatable to them to get into those investments. But again, as I just mentioned, the speculation going on in Bitcoin in the exchanges that you mentioned, Coinbase, and obviously there's others. That's a very, very tough proposition. I think if I'm a pension fund manager and all of a sudden I think, okay, well, I'm going to dump a bunch of my pension assets into this because of the volatility. Now, one thing that has occurred within the course of the last, what, 2 or 3 weeks is now for the first time, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the exchange in New York are trading Bitcoin futures. Now, of course, you're not ever going to receive, unlike other futures where the deliverable might be, you know, a barrel of oil, a bushel of wheat, et cetera, mm-hmm. there is no Bitcoin deliverable, and this is all cash settlement. So that has allowed, if you will, some expansion of potential, and I'll use the word investment into Bitcoin, in this case, Bitcoin futures, in a regulated exchange, because one thing that you have some comfort in if you're in a futures exchange is that you, in theory, because you have an exchange there, you don't have to worry about a counterparty, problem there as far as delivery, because, you know, the exchange essentially will make, one party whole if the other party, is not able to fulfill the terms of the contract. Now, what's interesting about that on the futures exchanges is that the leverage that's allowed for trading Bitcoin right now is not very high at all. Whereas, you know, you may have a futures contract where you're putting down, you know, 10, 15, 20% of the actual value of the contract. I thought I had read that for these Bitcoin contracts that it's like 85 to 100%. So in other words, there's not very much leverage there. So, which is good and bad, you know, so the good part is if it goes against you a lot, you know, you're not highly leveraged and can get wiped out, you know, very, very quickly. But, you know, the bad part is, okay, well then, you know, you're not leveraged, so you don't make as much money. But, so in essence, there, as it becomes more mainstream and again, getting it on a commodity exchange was a game changer, because now at least you have some regulated administration of it. But again, I still go back to, you know, you're asking about 2018. I don't see right now that this landscape has changed so far with respect to Bitcoin as a utility, as a unit of money, where the utility value is really, really high. So because of that, it still remains in that very highly speculative realm.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. And I guess another speculative measure is that we hear a lot in this space is that people are talking about cash and getting rid of cash. So in your opinion, what's wrong with abolishing cash?
That's something that has been advocated by some really top name economists that you hear in the news media. And it's really a disturbing conclusion to me for several reasons. I understand why there would be a nirvana for central bankers to have everybody out of cash, because when that would occur, then you could get into some of the machinations of central bank policies like negative interest rates. You know, if you impose a negative interest rate, and what negative interest rate basically means that you're getting less money back than you put into, quote, the investment. Yeah. And there's negative interest rates in Europe right now. There's not in the United States. And so if let's say, for example, in the United States that a bank had a negative interest rate, so you put in $1,000 and at the end of the year you got back $990. Well, you'd say, well, I'm not going to do that. Well, so then what that would force would be more people into cash, right? Because the cash would not lose that value like it would if it was in the bank or whatever other investment it is. And so that's something that allows a participant in the economy to have some protection, if you will, from a negative interest rate. And again, for the listeners from the United States, yeah, we don't have negative interest rates here, but there's a lot of European debt right now, sovereign debt, that is at negative interest rates, which means, you know, you're going to get less money back than you put into it. So that's one issue. The second issue is something that I think hopefully the recent natural disasters in Florida, Texas, and Puerto Rico will show you what happens when you have a significant infrastructure impairment, you know, electricity and so forth. What would it mean if, you know, you tried to go to your ATM and withdraw money if there's no electricity? Or maybe there is electricity, but maybe the ATM network is down. You know, what would it mean if you were at home and, you know, you were trying to trade Bitcoin and, you know, you don't have power, right? And you can't get on Coinbase and do anything. And you hear on the radio, because you've got this battery powered radio, oh, you know, the price of Bitcoin is cratering right now. So the thing that cash will always have is it's a measure of protection for you in those two cases that I mentioned. A third one that I mentioned in my books is actually for things related to identity theft. Imagine that you were the victim of identity theft and all of a sudden your credit cards were essentially useless. You didn't have credit anymore. What would you do? Well, if you had cash, you know that you could probably go down to the gas station, get gas, you could get groceries, you know, maybe manage for a while you sort out what happens with the identity theft problem. And again, we know identity theft is a big problem still. Mm-hmm. So what I would caution people is, you know, the more and more you relegate more of your life towards the digital world, you're really losing a sense of control that you might have otherwise had. Cash is one of those elements of control that I think is really, really important, particularly as everything becomes far more digital.
So let me ask you this, Jim, as we begin to wind down. You know, 2017 was a very, interesting year politically. Going into 2018, it's going to be an interesting year. So I guess from your experience, and it seems like, you know, you have a foot in on politics as well. Do you see what's happening currently and what's going to happen in 2018 politically affecting anything in the cryptocurrency space?
No, I really don't. Those things I think are very separate from that. What I do concern myself with, though, is, you know, we've had a economic expansion, and I'll use that term in quotes, since the bottom of the market in 2009. It's been a very, very weak expansion. Some of the characteristics of things that happen in the late stages of economic expansions, or, you know, let's call them bubbles, because I think that we're in financial bubbles in stocks, bonds, certainly cryptocurrencies to a large degree, and you could argue housing maybe to a lesser degree. When bubbles pop, and we saw what happened in 2008 when it was very, very much focused on housing, yeah. It does become very political. And my concern right now is that whenever we had the 2008 financial crisis, while there was polarization in the United States, it was not to the degree that it is today. And so the concern is, we have this degree of polarization right now. And again, it doesn't matter whether you voted Republican or Democrat. And in my last book, it's called Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections, I really try to get people to focus in on, you know, some of the things that we've asked government to do, and probably why we're in some of the financial and economic predicaments that we're in today. And what I suspect is going to happen is when the bubbles pop, and I think what you're seeing in cryptocurrencies is kind of endemic of financial bubbles, financial manias, because of central bank policies that have basically pushed people to try to seek yield somewhere other than, you know, than a savings account and a CD. Yeah. It will make for some political fireworks. And I think that it could be very, very explosive, particularly as you move, you know, not even just in the midterm elections of 2018, but as you move closer to 2020, one thing that probably may have gotten overlooked in the 2016 election, we do know that neither candidate was particularly liked by their own party. But we also should observe that it had a higher percentage of people that voted for what I'll call alternative candidates or third party candidates in 2016 than we had seen since the 1992 election with Ross Perot. Yeah. I think that's very, very important to note. And it wouldn't surprise me, again, as you move, if the economy starts to unwind because of the financial bubbles that I've just mentioned, it will get more politically explosive, and there'll be that tug between people that say, you know, we need our government to help bail us out again, or, you know, the central banks to do something. And then you'll have another part that will say, no, that's exactly what caused some of these problems. So, very, very concerned about how the next financial crisis will unwind itself. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections, is to try to get people to kind of think through that process, because at the end of there'll be light at the end of the tunnel, but it'll be a long and kind of a tough tunnel to go through. But the economy will come out of it restructured, and it's important to understand how we want it to look. And it's even more important for people to really get involved civically and understand, you know, who's running for public office and ask the tough questions. Because, you know, let's face it, what we hear today, and we're staying on the topic of politics, you know, it's all what I'll call political fringe issues. I mean, it doesn't really get to the core of anything. And the media is largely responsible for that, because, you know, obviously they want to create sensation. It's about ratings, about, you know, having eyeballs on the station. But really, really important for people to get more and more educated, to kind of have some sense of control over what the economy is going to look like when it comes out the other side.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And it's actually just this year, just this past year, I've recently took an interest in politics and just learning more about what's going on in the economy, because I realize it impacts so much. For example, with the new tax bill that just passed, there's going to be some changes with that that's going to affect not only me, but people that I care about. So with something like that in the pipeline, you know, as opposed to watching what's on the mainstream media all the time, it's important to take a step back and really study and figure out what's going on in the world politically, socially and economically, because at the end of the day, you know, it all impacts us one way or the other. So.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, economics drives a lot of our political behavior. And if you don't believe that, I mean, look at what happened in 2016. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that happened with, again, statistically improving economic measures, right? So imagine if you have a situation where those economic measures that we have, our dashboard, what if those lights start to deteriorate? Maybe they're not green anymore. Now they're yellow, or they're getting into red. That could make from very, very explosive politics. And what I'm suggesting is we need to, as a society, as an economy, we need to really learn and understand and kind of take a step back and really ask tough questions, because that didn't really happen in the 2016 election. It got sidetracked with a bunch of other stuff. And unfortunately, I suspect that by the time we get to 2020, you're going to want to ask your political candidates some very, very pointed questions.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so Jim, you shared some very insightful information today, man. I'm really excited that you came on and to share. Where can people find your book? Where can people get a hold of you? If you could share that information, so we can get what I'll do is I'll link to it in the show notes so people will have access to it. But where can we find you?
Yeah, my author site is probably a good central place to find, certainly all of my books. And by the way, my books, I try to cater to a wide audience. They're available in print form, ebook form, and I also have a lot of them available in audio form. You know, we talked today about the nonfiction stuff that I've produced. I also have a fictional series that is three books. It starts around the year 2020 in the United States, and it centers on, believe it or not, politics, financial crisis, cyber terror, and the main character is a journalist. So I think it'll be very, very, appropriate, you know, given some of the salient topics that you hear, you know, in the news today. It kind of carries forth the United States in a few years. But my my author site is at jimmosquera.com. So that's JimMosquera.com. And that's all where all my author stuff is. There's links to some articles. My business that I mentioned at the very beginning, which again helps small businesses with consulting, financing, and debt mediation, is at sentinelconsulting.biz, S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L, consulting.biz.
Yeah. And so last question for you, Jim. So obviously, you know, it seems like your books would be a good place for people to start and gravitate towards too, if they want to get a larger perspective on what's going on and what to potentially expect. What else can people do to prepare for 2018 in the coming years? Because as you mentioned earlier, it's going to be the political arena economically, you know, it's going to be interesting, in my opinion. It's going to be very interesting. What piece of advice would you give people to help them prepare?
As difficult as this may be for some people, and I know this because I've talked to people about this, people need to slow down and read. whether they read what I write or somebody else, read and educate yourself, because you know education is a very, very powerful weapon to have in your arsenal. And as I stated in the book that I wrote, Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections, if you can't figure out the right questions to ask, then, you know, you're going to get more of what you saw in 2016 and what you've seen since then. And again, I don't mean that specific to a political party or the 45th president. That's not what I mean at all. What I mean is, you know, figure out what questions you want to ask. But if you don't know what questions you want to ask until you read and educate yourself. So part of that is, you know, pushing away from social media, you know, pushing away from things that tend to distract people. And the best advice I can give to people is just read, you know, listen, you know, try to educate yourself, because it becomes very, very easy for, you know, politicians, what I call the wizards that are in Washington, D.C. or central banks to say, okay, we're going to do this. And everybody says, oh, okay, well, that sounds great, you know, and that it may not be the right prescription. And I would advocate strongly that it's not the right prescription, but you're never going to have an intelligent conversation between political candidates that you see on TV until you get people demanding that, you know, that you ask the right questions.
Yeah. I agree 100%. So I know I said that was the last question, but as you were talking, something came up because one of the vows that I have for 2018 for myself personally is to do a lot more. I mean, I do a good amount of reading, but it's to drastically increase not only the amount, I guess, how many books I read in 2018, but the type of books that I read. And I've recently been picking up a lot of autobiographies. And one of the overarching things that came to my mind was the importance of understanding history. And realizing what certain people did or how certain situations were handled in a historic event. So I'll ask you this, and then we'll end with that. Do you believe studying and understanding history is important to help us move forward?
Chuck, that's a great, great point. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, if particularly with respect to American history, kind of understanding, you know, I talk about this in other interviews when I start talking about, you know, how did the U.S. dollar get to be the U.S. dollar? You know, why is gold important? You know, and yeah. So to your point, if you go back in history, whether it's American history or other, you see history tends to repeat itself. It just doesn't repeat itself the same way. And I'm a really, really big believer in cycles. So it's important to understand if you go back and you read, you know, take a piece that's from 100 years old, you can kind of see some of the thought processes of people in government, you know, people on Main Street, people in investment markets. And you see the same things kind of cycle through. And if you believe in cycles like I do, that understanding and that knowledge of history is important to understand how something may develop in the current environment and maybe what you want it to look like, you know, and again, as we get through the tunnel and we see the light at the end of it.
Awesome. Jim, again, thank you so much for coming on. Again, we'll link to everything in the show notes as well. And potentially looking forward to having you in on in the future.
Chuck, it's been great being with you today.